Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Veterans Day. World War I was known at the time as the Great War, officially ended when the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28th of 1919. But fighting ceased 7 months earlier when an armistice between the Allied nations and Germany went into effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. In November of 1919, President Woodrow Wilson proclaimed November 11th as the first commemoration of Armistice Day. On June 1st of 54, at the urging of the Veterans Service Organizations, legislation was passed to honor American veterans of all wars, Veterans Day. And we mark Veterans Day this hour with three veterans of two wars. And actually, I would imagine we'll hear from many of you in the audience who are veterans as well, perhaps of other wars. Our guests with us today are veterans of World War II and the Korean War. Bill Van Ark is joining us in our Milwaukee studios, Army Master Sergeant, Lieutenant, and a Combat Infantry Platoon Leader during the Korean War. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for the service. And when were you in Korea?
I was there in 1951 and 52.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about your experience in a moment. Also joining us is Glenn Dorman, Korean War Army Major. Glenn, a Silver Star honoree who was wounded three times in battle and was nominated for the Medal of Honor. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. Arlen Lampke is also here. Arlen, a lieutenant colonel in the Army Air Corps during World War II. He served from 1943 to 1946. He flew C-47s and was stationed on the East Coast and later stationed near the Arctic Circle. Arlen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Our pleasure. And I understand you just returned from an honor flight, Arlen, just recently?
Yes, Saturday.
Oh, and just on Saturday?
Yes, Saturday the 7th, and what an awakening.
Was it? How so?
Well, as a result of that, I have now picked up a minor case of survivor's guilt or survivor's... anyway, what you do, you feel guilty when you see all... I went to the World War II Memorial, saw that curved wall with 4,080 gold stars on it, each one representing 100 deaths or missing in action. That's over 405,000 killed in action or missing in action, and here I am alive.
Oh, but you've lived a good life. You shouldn't at this point in your life feel that guilt, should you?
Pardon?
You've lived a good long life, and I'm sure you've lived it well. I don't want you to feel guilty at this time in your life.
Well, you can't help it. When you've been there, it is. Today, by the way, is my 92nd birthday.
Oh, my goodness. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah.
Yes. Sounds good.
That's great. Bill is agreeing with you. Did you feel survivor's guilt as well, Bill?
No, I did not. But I, as you go through those monuments, you'll see some of the fellows, they would be staring off into space, and you would know that by looking at those memorials and by being there physically, that they were having memories. I'm sure they were, and it was a touching experience.
When were you there? When did you go on the honor flight?
I was on the honor flight on November 2nd, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 years ago.
Yeah. And was it as moving to you?
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
It was. I was interested in seeing how they structured the Second World War Memorial, because if you look down from the Lincoln Memorial, then you looked over the reflecting pool, and then on the other end of that pool is the monument, the Washington Monument. And I was curious to know how they were going to structure that World War II memorial so it wouldn't obstruct the view of the Washington Memorial. You know, everybody has a memory of that reflecting pool when Tom Hanks character jumped in the pool.
Right.
And so... that was my concern, and I was really happy with the way they structured that memorial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's quite moving, too. Glenn, how about you? Do you feel survivor's guilt?
Not at all. I don't have that feeling. Never have. I think it's probably because I was on the front line as a rifle platoon leader for 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in that period of time, you see a lot of stuff. The average time that a rifle platoon leader lasted in Korea was less than 4 months.
Oh, my gosh.
So having been in it that long and stuck to it and trusted in the Lord to help me do that,
mm-hmm.
I trust that the Lord, I trust him, and I don't have any guilt feelings about it. No, and also, in my last battle, I was shot three separate distinct times, so you feel, okay, maybe I did my duty, you know?
Yeah, I think you did.
You get that reassurance heavily in your heart and in your mind, and thank God for all the people that helped me out. I measured it one time how many people were kind of in a direct support of me, and it went back to 18 different people.
Mm.
And that's going through the military mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think of all the civilians that made the bullets that I used and all of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. And if anybody comes to me and says they feel guilty, I say, look out.
Yeah.
I say, look, but for the grace of God, you would have been in my shoes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how each of you entered your service. Arlen, were you drafted or did you volunteer for World War II?
An aviation cadet. On it was December 5th, 1942.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, just went all the way through as a cadet. Graduated from Altus, Oklahoma as a twin-engine pilot. April 14th, 1944, with the wings of a pilot and a commercial pilot's license with instrument rating.
Mm. And I understand that you helped transport people who were in Normandy, is that right?
Yes. If you want to hear that story?
Yes, please.
All right. That is perhaps... I was on an honor flight Saturday, but this other flight was a greater honor.
Mm.
I was the first pilot in the Air Transport Command. That means that I was a captain. I mean, the captain of the ship, not rank. Anyway, we flew schedules. We flew all kinds of weather. But here was one day that I was off, was not scheduled to fly. And I was contacted to come down to flight operations and take a special flight. When I got there, it was unbelievable. Here was a C-47, absolutely, completely reconfigured as an ambulance ship. It was completely filled with people in stretchers, mm. or people who were unmobile, and it was such an honor, you can't believe it. And when I walked up the aisle to the cockpit, somebody said, hey Lampke, are you flying this thing? It was a fellow I knew as a cadet. But that's got to be the most honorable thing that I have ever participated in.
Mm.
And we took him, I flew him to Fort Devens.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Bill? How did you enter the service?
I enlisted in the service right after high school.
Really?
I think I entered the service in 1948. If you recall, World War II was coming to a close, and so we never thought we were ever going to enter into another war again. And I can remember I was sitting in my room and at Fort Bragg, in North Carolina, and a fellow came in and said, Bill, we're at war. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. Where are we in war? And he said, well, we're in a war in Korea. And I said, I don't believe that. And I got up and I went over to the post library and I read all I could find on Korea. But so that's how I entered.
Mm-hmm. And from what I have heard from other Korean vets, that was a particularly difficult war, wasn't it? It was heavy, heavy casualties. It was freezing cold. It was very hard.
Well, it was. You know, both ends of the spectrum. If you look at the 38th parallel, that's pretty much the kind of weather that you have here in Wisconsin. But when you got north of that and way up by the Yalu, then that's where those guys really suffered on that winter of 1950. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how about you? Did you figure that it would be as difficult a climate as it would be as difficult a war to fight, Glenn? Korea?
Are you talking to me?
To Glenn, yes.
Yes. It was a different kind of a war. In fact, it was so different to me, it was three different wars in one. In 1950, they had to cope with the Chinese coming in the end of October in that time, and 300,000 enemy troops coming across and capturing and also surrounding, and some of the units found themselves alone without communication of any kind because they were so scattered.
Mm-hmm.
That's when General Dean was captured. And in that, in December, their commanding general of the armies there was killed in a car accident, or jeep accident. And it was just a terrible time to be. They had the Pusan perimeter where they were pushed all the way down to south of Korea. And that's when MacArthur came through with his landing in Incheon Harbor, along the west coast.
Mm-hmm.
And a treacherous 33 to 35 foot tide. So everything had to be timed perfectly and everything, and it did work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But I enlisted when I was 18 years old, but I got in when I was 19, and this was in 1946, January. So the war ended in August of 45. I had tried to get in earlier, but they weren't calling on us so much because the war was ending, you know. So anyway, in 1945 and 1946, January, I got in, and I was commissioned in October, and in January, I found myself on the way to Korea in peacetime. And I spent 2 years there from January 47 to January 49. At that time, and the biggest part of that was the election, their first free and honest election was held, and I was in charge of the town of Chumenjin up along the East Coast, where I was stationed almost the full 2 years. So, yeah, your question was it cold? Yes, it was cold in South Korea, too.
Mm-hmm.
And was it bearable? Yes. You know why? My gosh, do we get tough when we're on the front line.
Interesting.
You get all kinds of weather, and you're sleeping on the ground all the time.
Yeah.
And your thoughts are, tomorrow I got to go again,
right,
type of thing. And you just get tough. I'll give you an example. I weighed 168 pounds when I entered the Army. And when I was wounded, I weighed 185, climbing those hills and eating sea rations. And when I was wounded, in October 17th, I was put in the hospital, and then my wife came to visit me in January down in southern Indiana, and I weighed 212 pounds. So I went from 168 to 212 because I climbed those mountains, eat sea rations. And in all kinds of weather, we just couldn't get back to dispensary because nobody got sick. The only way you could get back was get shot. And so you get tough. You get really mentally and physically tough that way. So
yeah,
we could weather the storm.
Yeah. Let me get a historical perspective from all of you. I mean, I started the show by talking about Armistice Day and World War One, thinking this was the war that was going to end all wars, peace would reign forevermore, because it was such a horribly destructive to lives and civilizations war. And here we are in 2015, having fought in so many other wars. Arland, let me just pose a philosophical question to you. Did you think when you were fighting in World War II that would be the war that would end all wars? And what do you think it is we can do? Because I'm sure, I don't know what it's like to be in war, but I'm sure that it's horrible. And I'm wondering why we keep thinking that this is the last one we're going to fight.
Well, never crossed my mind that it would be the last war, just like the First World War wasn't the last war. And I have no concept, even vague, of where we may go from here regarding wars.
Bill, how about you?
Well, if you remember, World War One was supposed to be the war that ended all wars.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, 20 years later, we were back in war. Part of the the reasoning for the Second World War, I believe, was when we in our process of splitting up the countries after the war, the First World War, they gave Sudetenland to Czechoslovakia, and I think that bore heavily on part of the reasoning for the start of the Second World War. After that, no, I didn't even envision that we were going to have another war so soon after the end of the Second World War. But Glenn is the major from Korea. I just would like to know how he ever got fat eating sea rations, because I can tell you I certainly did not. To answer your question, we didn't even think about another war that was coming. So if you remember, at the end of the Second World War, our major concern was the Cold War and the advancement of communism across the globe.
Right.
And then the Marshall Plan entered into that also. And when you think back about the country of Korea, when at the end of the Second World War, Russia and the United States decided they were going to split that little country in half along that 38th parallel. And when they did that, and if I can back up a little bit, you have to remember at that time that China was in turmoil in 1949. They changed into a communist format of government. And so we weren't really concerned about that. Either was Russia. Russia just had a small part of that bordered on Korea, way up in the northeast corner. But anyway, for whatever reason, in keeping with the Marshall Plan, they split that little country in half, drew a line across there, and families were split because of that. I think that was a cruel way to do that. But then the North, the communist government in North Korea, decided that they were going to unify that country, and so that's what the invasion was all mm-hmm. about to the South. Of course, because of the Marshall Plan, we considered the South a protectorate, mm-hmm. and that's how we got involved in that war at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arlen, do you think that there was a substantial difference? Certainly World War II was a nationwide event that everybody sacrificed in the United States, nobody as much as those who served in the war, but there was great sacrifice. Was there something different about that war? Was there something about the enemy that was being fought, the worldwide danger of a Hitler, that made it, you felt that the world was with you, or many in the world were with you, that the country was with you in sacrificing? Was it a different kind of war in that respect?
Yes, it was very charged. Not only Hitler, but the Japanese that
right.
attacked on Pearl Harbor, that's what did it. It was that attack that actually triggered the entry into the war. Otherwise, we were sort of trying to stay on the edge and lend lease and support without being openly supportive. In other words, not to antagonize Germany. But I remember the day. I remember Pearl Harbor, the day.
What happened that day?
Well, that was Sunday. That was the what happened.
No, I know what happened. What happened? How do you remember your day?
Oh, I just remember it as it.
Hmm.
I can remember hearing about it and wondering what on earth that meant.
Hmm.
Yes, but I'll tell you, that triggered America into a fighting mode.
How do you deal, as a soldier, each of you, with justifying why it is that you're putting yourself in harm's way? Are you doing it for country? Are you doing it because of a threat? Do you have to rationalize that every day as you're fighting? Are you doing it for the people you're fighting with, trying to stay alive? I mean, there's some really deep, profound kinds of questions that must come to mind when you're at war. Bill?
No, I don't think I ever gave that a thought. I was in the service, you know, prior to the war starting. When I got my orders to go over to Korea, that was just part of my job, and I accepted that. You know, there's always a concern. I don't think fear ever entered into that, but it was always a concern that am I going to see this country again?
I'm sure.
And so I think if the other two can agree with that, I think that that's maybe a motivation to do a good job while we were doing that, so that we ensured that we and those people that we were responsible to and responsible for would join us on our way back home again. And so obviously that didn't happen for a lot of people that we know. And I think, as the one gentleman said, I just prayed and I thanked the Lord for allowing me to come home.
Mm-hmm. Arland, were you afraid?
Well, I was really never in danger, but what I think really triggered America into fighting was the fear that the Germans were going to actually invade and conquer England, and then they would ultimately attack us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the really source of impetus. There was fear for the world when I went in, and that's about all I can remember. Is so a lot of that was propaganda, but there was fear of world domination by Germany.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, were you afraid?
Pardon?
Let me put it this way. I was stationed at home here in what we call a leader's course. I was an instructor there. Had been there for about a year and a half, and then while there, we would get a report of the casualties coming in at the end of 1950 there, you know. And names that I came across that I knew, guys that I knew had gone over, and their listed as killed in action, mm-hmm, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So being only a first lieutenant, I knew exactly where I would be going. I knew I'd be a platoon leader or a company commander. That's just the way it was. So, yes, you have apprehension, and you hope along the way as you're sailing over into a ship that maybe I'll get a better assignment. Well, I hadn't real fear on the way over, but as soon as I got orders to get on that doggone train down in the bottom part of Korea and go on up to the front line, I knew what I was in for. I could hear the booming of the artillery as we approached the area. They dropped us into 2.5-ton trucks and brought us up to our assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And this might interest you. The black fellow went over with me, and he and I were instructing on the 30 caliber carbine. We were the instructors for the officers on the way over. And I got to be good friends with him. He was in my cabinet there. We had 8 officers in one room. And all the way over, we all became friends. He ended up going up the train with me. He ended up getting into the 2.5-ton truck. We went up to the 1st Cavalry Division in the rear. And the truck stopped behind there by this building. And out came a captain. He walked up to behind me in the back of a 2.5-ton truck, and he said, "So-and-so, Lieutenant so-and-so here." He was sitting right next to me, this black man, against the bulwark of the truck. And he got up and he said, "Even here." Never said another word, went back, jumped off the truck, and no black person had ever served in a white unit. So here, I lost track of him, naturally, because we didn't know where he went. He lost track of us, too. So it was a little different kind of a war. But later on, when I was in the war, as a rifle platoon leader, I think it was about in April, March or end of March or April in that area, President Truman desegregated the units.
Mm-hmm.
I got 3 black boys into my unit. I should say men, because they're 18 to 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do with them? Shall I split them up and put them in different squads? Or shall I leave them together? What would be the appropriate thing for these poor guys who look like they're kind of lost? Well, one guy was really big, So I thought, well, I'll put him in the machine gun squad and let him carry the A4 machine gun, which is the tripod machine gun. And his two buddies, they said, why don't you be the ammo carriers? And that's what we did. For the first 2 weeks, they were not too good. But after that, they started to shape up. I will admit, I did a lot of yelling down the hill to have them join me, because I needed those machine guns for in case of a counterattack. So pretty soon, the big guy, he put that tripod machine gun up on his shoulder all together. And he'd carry it that way, and the boys carrying all the ammunition. When I'd get up there, all I had to do was point a finger, and he'd run over there, and he'd throw that doggone machine gun, fly through the air, land, and the guys were loading already. He got to be a kind of a morale factor for our platoon. They did a beautiful job. Now, we got back to June, and we got into a really bad fight. But I got out of that deal to go to R&R. No, it was August. I'm sorry, in August. I went to R&R, and another fellow came in, and they went into this next fight. Well, when I came back, I found out that this big black guy ended up being the platoon leader. And for 5 days, he was the platoon leader, as I was the executive officer back of the heavy weapons company. I'm sitting there one day, and I hear this yelling, Lieutenant Dorman! Lieutenant Dorman! Here he is, sitting on his butt, legs spread apart. He's up at the aid station. He'd been shot through the muscle.
Leg, oh.
The thigh. Mm-hmm. He'd been shot through one side, out the other, through the other leg and out the other. And he said, I got the $1 million wound, sir. They had done a really good job, but here he was wounded, and the two ammo bearers had been killed.
Oh.
So, you see, you talk to me about a black fellow going on into war, you know what I'm going to say.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to welcome phone calls on this Veterans Day. We have three veterans with us who served in long ago wars, the World War II and the Korean War. Our guests are Arlen Lampke, Lieutenant Colonel in the Army Air Corps during World War II, serving from 43 to 46, flying C-47s. Glenn Dorman is Korean War Army Major, Silver Star honoree, wounded three times in battle, and nominated for the Medal of Honor. Bill Van Ark is joining us in our studios here in Milwaukee, Army Master Sergeant, Lieutenant, and a Combat Infantry Platoon Leader during the Korean War. Here's how you join our conversation. We're interested in hearing from those of you who are veterans. You can also bring up any of the issues associated with veterans, how we've honored veterans when they have returned, the problems that vets may face, medical problems as a result of having served. If any of our guests were able to avail themselves of educational opportunities as a result of serving in the wars, how they... what frame of mind they put themselves in to do what you have to do to fight in Korea or to fight in World War II. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number. Lines are open for you this Veterans Day. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to go to phone calls in a moment. Arlen, I know you can't stay with us for the whole hour, so let me put this question to you first before we talk to our other vets. I'm wondering about your transition from serving in World War II to becoming a civilian again. Was it a difficult transition, and were there things that this country did for you to make that transition easier?
Well, yes. First of all, my service extended from... December 5th, 1942, for 40 years, 11 months, and 6 days active in reserve.
Oh.
So I have quite a bit of military service. But yes, when I came out, I took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights, and I got a diploma in structural engineering. And as a result of that, that was at La Crosse Trailer Corporation in La Crosse, Wisconsin. As a result of that, I went up to be the head of the structural engineering department. We did some fantastic jobs. So, yes, there was help to get an education. But I do want to add one thing that didn't come up.
Yes, sure.
This was very, very sad. But this was a person I personally knew, belonged to the church I belonged to. This was World War II now. He was drafted, did not get any training at any base, trained on a ship on the way to Italy, and was killed at Anzio.
Mm.
Tragic.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that in your life? If you're in a war, and certainly in World War II, and Korea had a lot of casualties as well, the loss of the friends, people you knew. I had people I knew in Vietnam who died, and somehow it's just, you think about that during the course of your own life, don't you?
Yes, you do. And by the way, on this honor flight, I was most impressed by the Vietnamese War Memorial. Here they have these larger-than-life
Yes.
concrete soldiers slogging through, and you're led to believe that they're in a marsh or a rice paddy. Believe me, that drove home to me, and I've always been more than sympathetic toward those fellows who served in the Vietnamese War, fellows, women as well, who came back here and were treated like scum. That has hurt me all my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arlen, thank you very much for being with us. I'm so glad that you were able to go on the honor flight this past weekend, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I want you to know, it was really an honor to speak with you and with the other gentlemen, and to be on your program. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Arlen. Arlen Lamke served in World War II and was in the reserves then for some 40 years. Lieutenant Colonel in the Army Air Corps, flew C-47 stationed on the East Coast and also later near the Arctic Circle. Yeah, he mentioned I think he was just confusing the Vietnam Memorial and the Korean Memorial. What do you think of the Korean Memorial? It's different than many of the others. Is it a moving bill? Memorial, do you think, in Washington?
It really is. I think Glenn brought this up, and for every one of us that they put on the front line, there were 13 support people. And so with the Korean War Memorial, it's kind of like a triangle, and then they have a squad of infantry that is marching over supposedly a rice paddy field toward the reflecting pool at the point of the triangle, toward the reflecting pool and the flag. The only mention of deceased at the Korean War Memorial is a block of granite, not very large, and it's just the inscription on there is dead. And then the 54,246, those numbers underneath that. That's the only place that they mentioned the deceased. But the granite wall, the people that built that wall and the thought process that went into that, what they wanted to do is they wanted to build a memorial to all of the people that served during that war. And so they beautifully etched into that wall figures, faces of people, and there were soldiers, tankers, all of those people that supported us. So you think about that in terms of numbers. They had a tanker, a vision of a tanker on there, and there were Air Force people in there and sailors. And then when you get down to the people that you really don't think about, but they really were very, very meaningful to us and their comfort while we were there. And I'm talking about people who were in supply, who kept us fed and kept us clothed and had shower facilities for us when we came off the line. And then you think about the guy who was probably most important to a lot of people was the mailman.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, the guy who brought your mail to
right.
you, and then the nurses and the doctors, and so all of those, and the cooks and the bakers.
Sure.
So they imposed those kind of figures on that granite wall, and it's really outstanding, and it's really moving. I think it's the only memorial there that has done that.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them, you know, like the Vietnam Wall, are all the names of the people who were killed during that
right.
that thing. And then the World War II had the stars, the gold stars that were put on there for indicating that there were 500,000 who died during that particular war. So I was really impressed with the way that they did the Korean War. I'm very thankful for that, for those people who put that together.
Yeah, those are meaningful to people who serve, to everybody, but to people who serve, too. Let's go to some phone calls for both of you. Chris in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hi, my family has a rather astonishing level of military service. My father's family had seven people serving in the military. Three were on Iwo Jima. My father flew planes over the English Channel from Dover into Nazi Germany, dropping people off for spies. And then there was a series of people that were in the Korean War, and one served in Japan over the course of the rehabilitation of Japan. And then I just recently lost a second cousin. She did two terms of duty in Iraq and got sent to Kosovo, and she was assassinated. So anyway, this is just a shout out.
Thank you very much, Chris, for your call. Maddie is next in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hello. My brother's name was Vernon W. Cornelius. He was a member of the Oneida Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, and he fought in the sort of an epic battle of the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, and he was in the 1st Marine Division. And anyway, that was just a horrific experience for those people. And they were totally surrounded by the Chinese communists, and it was winter, and they had to battle their way out of there. And he was a very, very proud of his Marine unit. And but when he came back, he did survive and come back. He had such an almost impossible job to find a time to find a job, and I suppose it was worse because he didn't have a high school diploma.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, I was recently to Washington D.C. and did see the Korean Memorial,
mm-hmm.
and I really appreciated it. And I just wanted to let people know that there are many Oneida tribal members who have really fought for this country through the years. And in World War II, there was a tribal member that stood out that I interviewed and tape recorded by the name of Amos Christian, who whose job it was to take out to go along out with the ships to check the degaussing, to see to it that the mines would not get triggered as the ships went over mines, and also to check the navigational equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there have been many Oneida, and Native Americans played a huge role in World War II as well as coders, right? Glenn, do you want to respond to what she said, Maddie said?
Well, I think that she hit the nail on the head pretty well. What that was Chosin Reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
I had good friends who were involved in that. I had one fellow who was the mechanic for the C-47s, and I wanted our pilot to know that I flew in many C-47s when I was in Korean peacetime.
Oh. Huh.
Our airport was way out on the East Coast, so we had three flights a week. And so many times I flew on the C-47.
Hmm.
Anyway, she hit it right on the head because there was a lot of frostbite. It was just a terrible thing. People lost their toes and other things that were affected by it. This fellow that was a mechanic, how would you like to keep any kind of engine going in 40, 50 degrees
really?
Below zero wind chill factor?
Yeah.
And they had their fingers frozen, and what they had to do was let the planes run. So gasoline was a big thing. You had to have how are you going to get all of that when you're surrounded by Chinese enemy?
Mm-hmm.
And they fought their way back. They fought their way out to the port, and then they all got on to LCMs, landing craft marines, and other ships, and they shipped back out and exploded and blew up the whole harbor and did a beautiful job of escaping the enemy there. So they always said, we didn't retreat, we fought our way out. And that was true. Mm-hmm. They had to do that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matty, for your call. We have time for a couple more. Our number is 800-486-8655. On this Veterans Day, we are honoring and hearing the stories of now two veterans of the Korean War. The gentleman who was just speaking is Glenn Dorman, Korean War Army Major, Silver Star honoree, wounded three times in battle. Bill Van Ark, Army Master Sergeant, Lieutenant, a combat infantry platoon leader, both served in the Korean War. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Arlen made the comment before he had to leave us that he was very upset by the way Vietnam vets were treated when they returned to the United States. Do you share his upset? And what about the way the Korean vets were treated when they came back to the States?
We came back to silence, and that's why the Korean War is called a forgotten war. Nobody wanted to think about a war again so soon after the Second World War. And I remember, I think it was about 15 at the end of the Second World War, and if you recall, they had a big celebration down in at Times Square, and a Navy, the seaman, was kissing the nurse.
Right.
That became an iconic picture.
Yes, it did.
And I didn't know that till just recently, that there's a statue of that same thing somewhere. I don't know where that statue is. But anyway, I didn't know where we were going to come back, and we did. We came into San Francisco, and I remember saying to a friend of mine, when I get off of this boat, when I get off of this ship, I'm going to replicate that incident. I'm going to grab a girl and kiss her. And when we got off, there was nobody there.
Oh, there was no one there.
There was no one there. There was just a major that was standing there, and he asked me what my name was. And when I told him, he simply said, well, when they offload the luggage, yours is going to be over there in a corner. And so I waited till they offloaded, grabbed my luggage, and a bunch of us then hopped a plane, and we were off to our next duty station. So there was not much recognition, but there wasn't for anybody. If you think about the Second World War and those veterans, they didn't come home immediately after the war. You know, they had to stay there for the stabilization of Europe. And when they did come back, unfortunately, they hit the East Coast. They trucked them up over to the West Coast, and they were off fighting in the Pacific again. So not everybody got a ticker tape parade. And that's why it's so important that we continue with the Honor Flight program, so that all of these veterans who had not seen any kind of welcoming home ceremony, they get to go to Washington, D.C. and see these monuments that were built for those conflicts, but they were the greatest share of that conflict, and so they need to get there to see that.
I agree. Well, it's too bad there wasn't a lovely young woman right outside that ship, and you could have explained to her why you wanted to give her a kiss, and she would have said yes, I'm sure, don't you think?
Yeah.
That's
hopefully
quite a story.
So.
Right, yeah. Let's go to Kay in Eagle River next. Hi, Kay.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Real well, thanks. Good. I just wanted to give a wonderful thank you, a heartfelt thank you to the Never Forgotten Honor Flight out of Wausau. My dad and I went on it in April. He's 92, and he was in World War II, and it was just absolutely beyond words, fabulous. If anybody ever has a chance to go on one of these, please bring your loved one on there, because they're just phenomenal, and what they do for these guys is just amazing. I can't say enough about it. And also, too, it's, you know, all these older people are just walking, living, breathing history books that you know, if you talk to these people, it's just amazing the stories they have and what wonderful, you know, perceptions they can give you about what happened back then. I mean, we asked my dad, you know, where were you when they bombed Pearl Harbor, and where were you when FDR died? And just, I mean, it's just amazing to be able to talk to somebody that actually was lived through those times.
Yes.
So that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
They're just wonderful.
Thanks.
I never forgotten Anna Flight.
Yeah, thanks, Kay. It's a terrific program. I'm sure you agree with everybody's assessment, Glenn, of it. It's such a good program.
Yes, it is. It's very nice. I had been to Washington, D.C. 5 or 6 times previous to that, so I held off because there's so many guys that wanted to go, and they're on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And, people kept pestering me about it that had been on the thing and insisting that I go. I got 3 or 4 applications handed to me through the months, and finally I thought when my grandson's mother-in-law a full book on the honor flight and an application blank. I thought, this is it. I signed up for it, and I got on in July, on April 18th of this year, and so I recommend it to everybody, anybody that wants to go, or even isn't thinking of going. I'll tell you, go, just go. You will be surprised what's going on. I thought that was the nicest thing. I didn't realize how many people would come out for this sort of thing.
I know. It's just wonderful to see what people do.
People come
yes.
out. And so it's, I didn't know how to act when I came through those lines. Good grief. I remember my one daughter's boyfriend saying, I thought you were running for election the way you came through.
Maybe that's what you should have done. It would have been a perfect way to start your campaign, wouldn't it? Oh, that's funny. Thank you very much, Kay, for your call. Nancy in Grafton, hi.
Hi. My husband's uncle, Adolf Paspahala, he was up in Marathon County, and he was shot down and never found. It was either in the Red or the Black Sea. We didn't know because he was only a young boy when this happened. And is there a monuments or something for those people who have been lost and their bodies have never been found? And is there a memorial? And also, I wanted to say, when we were little kids going to country school, we would go out into the swamps and we would pick milkweed pods and take them in gunny sacks to school. And they were taken, I don't know where, supposed to make life jackets for the soldiers.
Huh.
And I thought that was, I don't know if that ever happened, but we were picking milkweed pods, I'll tell you that.
Hmm. Bill, can you help her? Glenn, can you help her?
No, you're going to have to talk to somebody other than me because I don't have the answer to that.
Do you, Glenn?
Oh, all I know is that there was a lot of, in the Second World War, there was a lot of saving iron, steel, and that sort of thing. And we in school had to buy these little stamps. War stamps, they called them.
Yes.
Combat stamps. I don't know. War stamps, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd get a little red cross for tuberculosis. They'd stick that in your. And it was all for the war.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of rationing. Mm-hmm. Where people here in the United States really contributed to the war effort by collecting things that needed to be given to our troops. I'm very impressed with that. You read about that, that's very exciting. You know,
sure
you remember
is.
The old songs about Rosie the Riveter?
Sure.
Oh, I'll tell you, those gals really got started in that sort of thing in the Second World War. That was a good deal. So what she's talking about there, I'm not familiar with, but I'm not going to question it. That's
somebody,
great.
Yeah, somebody will send a message and let us know. We just have about 30 seconds left. Dan, who's traveling. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple of quick comments. My dad was World War II. I was in Vietnam. 3 years ago, I was in Normandy, and I looked at those 9,000 crosses there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, as horrible as that is, that was necessary because Hitler was such a maniac. The war that I was in and all of the wars since have not been necessary. They've supported the military-industrial complex. God bless our troops. God bless our veterans. And we just need to fix government so we stop sticking our nose where it doesn't belong. We have a Department of Defense, not a Department of Offense. So
Thank you, Dan, very much for your call, and thanks for your service as well. Well, gentlemen, thank you for being with us. I appreciate your being here on this Veterans Day. Bill, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Our pleasure. And Glenn, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, I appreciate you asking me.
Yeah, our
and
pleasure.
Bill?
Bill Van Ark and Glenn Dorman, and we thank them for being with us on this Veterans Day.